Hi, I'm Hemming Nelson.
And I'm Brian Kessler.
Welcome to the Digital Engagement Forecast. Today's forecast is brought to you by Charity Engine, our beverage sponsor. Charity Engine is a nonprofit software platform for online donor management, fundraising, events, and communications.
And if your CRM is driving you to drink, give Charity Engine a call.
Yeah. So here's our conversation with Ann Yoders.
Hi, nice to be here.
Hello, Anne. Anne, I understand I have my notes somewhere here. You're a Anne Yoders CSM DCMP.
I am. Do you know what that means?
I didn't know you were so credentialed. I'm going to guess CSM is Certified Scrum Master.
It is.
And DCMP?
I don't know what it is.
Where did you get that certification? Box of Cracker Jacks?
Direct Marketing Association Certified Marketing Professional.
Holy cow. I know. That's actually quite difficult to go through.
Yeah.
That's why it's an acronym.
Yeah.
So should we call you Dr. Yoders?
No.
Okay. But today we're talking about digital transformation. I've known you now for a couple years, and I know that the things that get you excited are kind of the big ideas. And something that you've been evangelizing about lately is the sirens outside, which is our neighborhood fire station. So we'll let those subside a bit. What gets you excited is really this idea of how technology is changing, particularly the nonprofit space, and how organizations are or are not meeting that challenge.
Yeah, and I was particularly excited just recently, actually this month in June.
More excited than usual?
More excited than usual. Fantastic.
What does that look like?
It depends on how much coffee I've had, but it can get pretty crazy. A report came out called The New Reality. Based out of the UK, a woman, her name is Julie Dodd, just came out in June and does a really nice job at summarizing a lot of the themes that you're hearing more and more in the nonprofit sector around digital transformation and the changes that need to happen in order for organizations to adapt.
Mm-hmm. And Brian and I attended an event that you hosted a couple months ago. It was pretty much the same exact topic. You had a panel of some association executives, and they were talking about how they were, you know, what kind of innovation was or was not taking place within their organizations. Some of the points that we heard you talk about there are highlighted in the executive summary of this new reality report. Mm-hmm. What's the key insight?
Yeah, I think one of the most important ones is around culture. So when you talk about digital transformation, you often get a view that what's happening is basically coming from the IT department. And that's actually one of the challenges is the view that, okay, this is happening over here in this department, so they're dealing with it. And so senior leadership doesn't necessarily need to get involved. And it's not something that's going to necessarily permeate the entire organization, which is far from the fact. It actually needs to be integrated throughout the organization. So it becomes a culture change
Sorry.
Effort.
Pause.
Damn, you're on a roll, too.
So, Anne, I think, what are some of the big, what do you want to talk about, the culture?
Yeah, well, leadership and culture combined, I think, is interesting because I think when people talk about digital transformation, they talk about that happening in one department, the IT department, when actually it's something that needs to permeate the entire organization. And that's one of the shifts that they talk about in the research paper. You mentioned the event with associations. And an interesting dynamic with associations is that 4%, it's been noted that 4% of the annual revenue, the budget for most association, goes to IT. So if you have a department with 4% of the budget advocating for major change, it becomes kind of an us versus them scenario. So you really need leadership to lead that change. That way it doesn't become, okay, the web guy wants us to do X, Y, and Z, and it becomes the web guy's issue.
Yeah. Well, it seems like it always becomes the IT department's issue, doesn't it? But you're right. This has to be driven probably by, you know, someone in the executive suite who's not going to be seen as, you know, having the decisions made based on their concept of what the technology is available, but really what the needs of the organization are.
Yeah.
Is that right?
That's exactly right. And what you hear, recently I was at a CEO event, a breakfast event, and they were talking about recruiting. And they were saying, well, for executive directors, people who are leading association or nonprofit organizations, they said one thing that executive directors really need to embrace moving forward is social media. And there was a few of us were caught by that. You might think that, okay, that's great. You know, they're really pushing that out there as something to embrace. It's kind of this limited perspective. Because social media is one part of an overall.
Yeah, it's just a distribution channel for your communications.
That's
not necessarily a strategy.
No, yeah, not at all. So it was evidence of the mindset in terms of the overall sector about how they view technology and its ability to really transform an organization and move it forward.
And a lot of your experience is really with this in the association world, right? A lot of your deep experience.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, when I think about association executives, I think about 60-year-old white men who play golf on the weekends. So how do you bring change to an organization that's led by someone who maybe doesn't even have a Facebook account?
Yeah, a couple of interesting things. There's a couple challenges there. One is I think there's a dynamic, and I'd love to get your opinions on this as well, dynamic between consultants and nonprofits. In desperate need of consultants able to walk into a nonprofit organization, association, and talk about the myriad of ways in which what they do can have an impact on operations. And where that's most powerful is when you can track it to a bottom line, whether that's revenue or mission. Where you get the dynamic in play, Brian, I'd love you to jump on this. The dynamic is in play is that as a consultant, I'm running my own business. So I want to speak to what you want to hear. So I don't want to necessarily offer this big pie-in-the-sky digital transformation plan when really what you need is a social media strategy. So it's sort of like, do you aim where they're at or do you aim where you think they need to be and hope an engagement evolves? And I think that dynamic can prove problematic overall to the overall growth of the sector and innovation. Would you share that?
Yeah, I think it's... you know, very much leans itself towards the view that you have about your relationship with your consultants. Are they actually consultants or are they somebody that you're just outsourcing mental labor to?
Mm-hmm.
And you don't really want them to be creative or to give you their opinions. You want them to do the work that you're trying to do. And in those instances, you know, actually having real conversations get shut down. Mm-hmm. So it's really... highly dependent upon what you view as your relationship with your consultants. Are they just augmenting your staff or are they there to help you develop or actually go through an organizational change or discovery?
Mm-hmm.
Are you saying that that's a shortcut to addressing some of these challenges is to bring in an outside consultant then? Is that part of your point?
Do recommend an interesting, I haven't heard this before, but I thought it was interesting, sort of a digital transformation officer, a limited engagement, where someone comes in with an outside view, so you're not in the weeds with the organization, you're not tied to the internal politics, and then you look for ways, almost like a digital SWOT analysis, you look for ways in which you can work with each department, not just the IT department, but each department, and modify what they're doing, refine it, so that they're using technology to help support overall strategic goals. So I kind of like that idea. I like that kind of digital transformation officer.
What's a SWOT analysis?
Strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats.
And this is an exercise you run through with clients. You put those columns up on a whiteboard, and then you run down and you fill them out?
Pretty much. It's okay. Pretty much. You have quadrants for each. So strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, threats. You go in and you do that analysis. It's used in strategic management for overall management of an organization. Mm-hmm. But do it through the lens of technology and digital. So where are you strongest? Where are you the weakest? Where are the opportunities? And I really like the idea of opportunities. I love the idea of being able to go in and say, if you just look at maybe your CRM, maybe the way you're collecting data, if you make these tweaks, and then being able to say, we can save you X dollars, or we can make you X dollars, we can increase donations if you just make this one subtle change to the way your CRM is structured. And that gets really into, like, okay, you're showing what's happening in the IT department as having ramifications on a strategic organizational level. And I think that's where you begin to get the attention of the leaders.
Is there something that precedes this, though, which is the moment where you realize that you're being left behind or your organization needs this kind of change? Is that driven by falling revenue, by competitors creeping into your space? Like, are there a few common threads that you could point out which might suggest, you know, hey, these are the red flags that you need to jump on this digital transformation bandwagon?
Mm-hmm. My opinion, and you'd find this in this paper as well, is that you should act before the red flags are present. In the association sector, what you find is there's one particular association that I have in mind right now. They had membership decline for over 3 decades. But they were, just because of the way associations are structured with a board and then the leadership and then their members, their constituents, all weighing in on what should be done, there was a certain paralysis that set in almost. Even though they were clearly struggling financially and struggling in terms of carrying out their mission, it was sort of like, what climate change? There's nothing wrong. We'll turn this ship around. And they did it until it was too late. Mm-hmm. And then they had to bring in someone who needed to make drastic changes. And it's highly unlikely that the organization will probably survive. So that's where they saw, okay, there's a lot of red flags. We need to do something now. But the likelihood of them being able to turn that around is challenging right now, and it's, I hate to shed a sort of a unfavorable light on it, but I would be surprised if the organization made it. So
have they heard you say this to them?
I haven't used the name, so I'm hoping it's.
I'm sure they're not listening. Don't worry. Or is this going to be news? So, your leadership now has bought into this idea. How do you go about finding that agent of change in the form of a consultant who might be able to help you implement?
Or I think there's also a role, and I'm going to put myself out there a little bit, for the N10s and the ASAEs, so the associations, those that are leading the sector, to advocate, take that leadership role and advocate at a whole different level for digital transformation and the need to take it much more seriously than sort of this abstract report that's generated that's people may read, may do something about, may not. Mm-hmm. That there's an urgency to it that needs real leadership across the board. So those those organizing bodies like the ASAEs and the consultants. And I think just to talk business strategy for a minute, it behooves the consultants to walk in and say, look, you have opportunity here. And what we do as a web development company or as a CRM provider, we can help support that. And while I know we're just talking about a website redesign, you should be aware that there's 5 other opportunities over here that can benefit your bottom line. And to help shape that conversation and really open the doors to new possibilities. Because as you know, when you're working in an organization, your head is down on whatever it is that's in front of you. You know, you're thinking about that CRM that you just need to get updated. You're not thinking about the bigger picture. A consultant is not tied to that. They can come in and say, this is what I'm seeing, here are your possibilities, and really kind of blow open that door. Whether they take advantage of that or not, clients, is another matter. Brian, you must have seen that a lot in your work, just with associations, where you can see the opportunities, and then you can see just the different challenges in embracing those.
Yeah, the crazy thing is usually they see the opportunities too.
They do.
It doesn't take very many meetings for them to all come to agreement about some simple things that for whatever reason have not changed or been overcome within the organization. And those things can go on for years or decades. In your instance, you said they had seen declining membership in 30 years. That doesn't surprise me. It gets deprioritized. Mm-hmm. And you don't get that external perspective to kind of bring it back into focus and say, are you really thinking about what this means for the organization? It may be too late at this point. You've been putting it off for so long. It seems very familiar to me. I think a lot of organizations, when you think about consultants, I think about it almost the same way when I hear about relationship consultants for couples, where providing that outside perspective is so important. If you needed couples therapy, you would not choose a family member or a close friend. Mm-hmm. And that's what happens when you grab somebody internally in the organization. They, no matter how well-intentioned, cannot truly provide a neutral or at least an outside-the-box type of perspective that a consultant can. Mm-hmm. And I'll throw it back at you, Anne.
Yeah.
One of the things that I think is interesting is the idea of bringing in that consultant, getting the assessment. And what role does potentially bringing in a second consultant play? Almost like getting a second opinion. If your doctor says, you've got this and this is the recommended treatment, and that's going to be a very large investment, unless you have an established trusting relationship with this consultant, how do you know whether it's worth the investment? Because it would be a significant investment of time and money to bring in a second consultant and see if maybe they confer on some of the points.
Yeah, I like that. It is challenging. When you're bringing in a consultant who's making wide recommendations that are going to have an impact on the organization that are significant, right? It's not just, you need this tweak to a CRM. It's where it's going to have there is going to need to be culture change, so it's going to have an impact on a much broader level. I would say, maybe I'm being overly cautious, but getting in a second or third opinion or just asking around is always a good thing. I would hope that any consulting that I would do would stand up to I would hope so. But I'm just thinking of the analogy of taking your car to, I'm not very good with cars, but taking a car to a shop, and someone sat across from me and said, okay, you need, $6,000 worth of work, I would want to get a second opinion. So I would support that.
Maybe bringing it to your trusted mechanic and then also one who has no previous relationship or invested interest, really.
Absolutely.
Trying to get two different perspectives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
And there'll certainly be overlap, but I think what would probably be interesting for the organization is where the differences are.
I agree. Yeah.
So if you've chosen your consultant, then it sounds like the first thing that you're really tackling is the organization and the culture. That's going to be your number one barrier, is that right?
Yeah.
So what does that look like?
I'll give you an example. There was an association based out of Rockville, and this has a couple different threads that I think is just fascinating. They brought my team in to do a strategy project. And essentially, they brought us in primarily because there were two departments that were at odds with one another. One wanted to basically build a sort of a member community platform, and the other side, we don't need that. Our members won't gravitate to that. And so they went. They basically paid a significant amount of money to have a consultant come in and do the research and say, okay, this is what we recommend. So they could settle it once and for all. And so we came in, did a bunch of research, and it turned out that indeed their members would not gravitate to an outside platform to communicate with one another. But it didn't solve.
How was that? The antagonism was still there?
It was still there.
So once you let that genie out of the box.
But what was more interesting about it, in the course of doing that work, and doing the, we did one-on-one interviews, we did focus groups, we did surveys, it was fairly extensive. And what was interesting is they said, the other challenge we have is that our annual meeting, common with associations, gets all the attention, gets most of the revenue that we get as an organization. It's like how we're known, but we have all these other programs, and it's not, those programs aren't getting any attention. And the thing is, most of the other programs were legacy programs that were 30, 40 years old, that for one reason or another, they didn't want to let go of. And they said, what we need help is to build an online experience that will take all the traffic that our event is getting and then help channel that to our other programs, so, you know, our members get involved across the board. And so we set in on that project, and what it came back through all this, all the user research that we did, is that they weren't interested in the programs. There was no online experience that could solve that problem. You know, and with, that was the hard, you got to walk a delicate line there.
Well, I was going to say that, I mean, you're walking into an organization where there's some conflict already, and now you're delivering bad news to
them. I was not a popular consultant.
And you're telling them that, you know, the organization, the tried and true programs that they run are actually not very valuable to them. So that's one way to change a culture, but is the reaction like, okay, they're just telling us we're doing everything wrong and therefore, you know, we're going to hire another consultant? Or was it like, hey, we hear what you're saying. It's a hard lesson to hear, but help us now sort of adopt the mindset that's going to be needed to get through this.
Yeah. I would say they approached it. They were receptive to it. I don't know that it solved some of those internal politics at play. They did bring on a new executive director after that for new leadership. They didn't change much of the board, which that was a challenge because the board was kind of tethered to the ways of doing things in the past. They did bring on a new executive director, and they did initiate significant staff turnover, so replacing staff that had been there a while, getting fresh new ideas, et cetera. And
you need to have, probably to do that in any way that's going to make a substantial amount of difference in the culture, you probably have to have a new leader, like a new CEO / president / executive director, who comes in and does a purge and says, this is now, we're going to imprint my personality on this organization. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's one way to do it, I would assume. But if you're going to be letting people go in any kind of larger capacity, that person's got to come in. It's got to be personality driven.
Yeah.
I'm just making assumptions. Is that?
I think so. And they reference this in the paper to the new reality where for the naysayers, the people who don't want the change, let them go. You either are committed to the change and the vision moving forward, or you play the referee, which is a lot of wasted energy.
And is there an alternative to that, which is use the existing personnel and coach them and train them and bring them along?
I think it's a case-by-case basis. I think it is. I think there's a lot of factors that go into that. Mm-hmm. Clearly, no one likes a loss of jobs, but I think it. You get to, and I think there's a, what was it? Is it Zappos that just introduced a new management, I'm forgetting the name of it, but introduced a sort of a new management approach. And the CEO was adopted or leave. That's strong, right? That's a pretty hard stance.
There's not a lot of organizations that are as progressive in terms of their thinking on those matters as Zappos.
Zappos also offers its employees money to quit immediately after being hired, which is really a culture-first approach. Mm-hmm. You might know of the culture before you work there, but if you come in and realize it's not a good fit, one bad employee has a multiplying effect. That toxic behavior and attitude can spread to others. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't have to be a negative thing. I mean, I actually think it's very smart to say, hey, if you identify yourself as somebody that's not going to be happy here, mm-hmm. we will pay you to leave, because bottom line is it will cost more for you to stay mm-hmm. because you will bring other people down. Mm-hmm. And so you get to leave happy. We get to be happy. You know, no regrets. And mm-hmm. so there can be that approach where if you do have to let people go, there are alternative options mm-hmm. to say, if you're not bought into this approach, here's another opportunity mm-hmm. for you to leave on good terms.
Mm-hmm. I'll rant by a little bit, and this is familiar to Anne, but for Zappos, there's a bottom line gauge to their success, which is, are they making money or are they generating revenue? And that's a very easy argument to make to your board or to make a decision based on that kind of feedback. If you're talking about a nonprofit, and especially an association, there's not a lot of built-in incentives that would drive that. I mean, there are drastic ones like all your members just quit. Mm-hmm. But there's, I don't know how many of them, have as direct a feedback loop as a for-profit organization. And in my mind, at least in the limited experience I have with associations, it's really life draining. I mean, it really leads to a lot of stagnation and paralysis, as you said earlier. Mm-hmm. So how do you overcome that? What are the arguments that you make to bring your board online, mm-hmm. or to bring your vice presidents to get them to buy in?
That's a really good point. So there's multiple bottom lines with nonprofits, and I'd love to not be so association focused, but segue to sort of advocacy or human interest groups. And but I think I'll speak again to associations, but this is true of advocacy organizations, is that you have, I usually segment it into, it's either mission oriented, mission driven, or revenue. Whether that's member dues or whether that's donations or foundation dollars. And what's interesting and what can prove challenging specifically with associations is that there might be something that's more mission related. Like with one organization I worked for, they had a lot of education programs targeted to high school and university students because they thought that was their future members. So they were investing. But that segment of their membership, they don't have any money. They don't have anything. They're not going to be investing a lot of money in the organization at that point in their lives. So there was not necessarily a return on that investment from the organization. That said, in terms of members, their current members, this is a really interesting dynamic with associations. A lot of times, member dues, what was used to be the heart of the way associations made money, is no longer the same as it was in the past. They can often lose money through that, just the outreach and support. So they anchor their efforts around annual meetings, which is high sort of revenue generator, and also journals producing content. But if you think of those two things, annual meetings, the decline in attendance for many associations. Why? Because of the ability to meet online. So that's being threatened. That's where that digital disruption plays. In terms of journal, I can go and do research for this organization focus on optics. I can go and do research around optics on Google. I don't have to become a member of this particular organization to access their journals. So both of those top revenue generators for this particular association are being threatened by digital disruption. I didn't answer your question.
Well, no, but I think you moved on to the next point, which is now, okay, so now we've identified the challenges. What are the tools that are available to leverage those traditional products that they offer and make them profitable? Mm-hmm. So what kind of infrastructure or IT solutions are we thinking about?
Mm-hmm. It's really changing the way, I think it's the same orientation to the services, but it's changing the way it's done. For example, with journals, content production, with associations, it's moving away necessarily from content production to content curation. Mm-hmm. So putting as an association, putting your stamp of approval on resources that are already out there, but not necessarily being on the hook to provide that research in the form of journals. So it's really rethinking the approach and leveraging what is already being provided. With annual meetings, it's my personal opinion that even with the ability to connect online, people will always want to connect in person. I think that that's my personal opinion.
Not a lot of people that work here feel that way.
Really? Yeah.
A lot of people like to sit up in the middle of the night and interact with their computer.
I'll put my hat in favor of in-person meetings. Yeah. But still, it's one of those questions where there is a decline in membership. There are multiple opportunities to get resources mm-hmm. through other channels. And it can really be a tough hurdle for a lot of these organizations to overcome. It actually reminds me very much of an interview with some of the higher-ups at the U.S. Post Office. Mm-hmm. And one of the questions they were posed was, if you could just redo the whole post office today, mm-hmm. what would you change? And their comment was they'd be more like Google, and they would actually do away with most of paper mailing and just put printers in more locations.
Interesting.
Right?
Yeah.
You know, you don't necessarily need to physically deliver something if you could mm-hmm. print it on demand. Mm-hmm. We know that. But they also are going through this identity crisis. Mm-hmm. I don't think the post office really knows what it is anymore. Mm-hmm. And a lot of organizations are doing the same. They're mm-hmm. seeing revenue slip, but they don't necessarily know what the answer is. It might be technology, it might be a culture shift, but it's very difficult, even if the answer is staring you in your face, to admit mm-hmm. that sometimes either drastic changes need to happen, or the model you've been operating on for several decades might not be relevant anymore.
Right.
It might be a fundamental
change. It's interesting you bring up the Postal Service. We were a subcontractor on a job about a year ago for the Postal Service, which was exactly that. Is like, what is the role of the Postal Service in the brave new world? And they're investing a lot of money in some pilot programs. And from what I could take, we had a very small piece of this, but from what I could take away, they're saying, okay, what is it about our brand that is valuable? And I think what the lesson was that people trust the post office. Like, mm-hmm. You trust them with your $1,000 check, and you know that it's going to be delivered. And so it's that their brand is the person who's going to safeguard your privacy mm-hmm. and deliver your information. And so they were looking into things like, you know, offering encryption services to like large corporations and some really cool stuff.
That's really smart. I'm going to butcher recalling this anecdote, but I want to say it was one of Malcolm Gladwell's books where he talks about actual perception of services mm-hmm. and offerings being important as well. And I believe it was like the UK Postal Service spent millions upon millions of dollars trying to bring their deliverability success rating, on-time success rating, up like an additional percent, because they were, I don't know, like 98% successful, and they got a lot of flack in the media, and so they spent millions and millions and millions of dollars trying to make it 99%. But in reality, the one thing that they were overlooking was perception of deliverability success.
Yeah.
And the perception was that only about 60% of their mail was being delivered on time. So if they had actually taken that money and put it towards a campaign to inform their customers about just how successful 98% of the time they are, that actually would have had more qualitative and eventually quantitative impact for their brand.
Oh, that's interesting.
And so your organization might be doing actually some things that provide a lot of value, but you're missing the trees for the forest. Mm-hmm. You are spending time on the wrong problem. Mm-hmm. You haven't identified. And that's
it's
where
all
consultants
about marketing, isn't it?
Yeah, but marketing can also ruin a lot of great things. So, but that's where also consultants can come in and provide that outside perspective. Like, yes, you've identified a problem, but you're focused over here. You need to look over here. Here's the real root problem, or here's where you're going to get more return on your investment. We have to address this first.
Yeah, terribly interesting. There was a client worked with last year. We, as someone who does digital strategy, you know, of course, my first thinking is what is the technology? What is the solution? It's oriented in that direction. But I caught myself in one particular instance at an event that they were holding, and they had experiential kiosk where they had e-posters. And I thought, wow, what you could do with it, you could connect that to the member directory and you could do all this cool stuff with this, you know, this experience, this e-poster. But when I actually went to the traditional e-poster where they literally have a bulletin board and then they have the poster pinned up on it, what I noticed is that all the researchers at the traditional e-poster session was gathered around the person presenting the poster, and it was like this community of people talking to one another and corresponding about the research. What was happening at the e-poster was there was one person interacting with the screen. And what you know about the culture of this organization and why it's been able to sustain itself for now, it's going on a 70-year anniversary, was around that community. When you went around and interviewed people at this event, they were all like, oh, do you know Bob and William and Joe? And so what are the long-term ramifications of introducing something like 400 e-posters where you have one person interacting with a screen and you're losing, culturally, you're losing that interaction at a key event? That's what everybody goes to this. Mm-hmm. So that was talking about the qualitative side of user research. I mean, that was an interesting observation for me where I had to check myself as a technology consultant. Mm-hmm.
So maybe technology in and of itself is not always the solution to the problem.
Right.
Technology should augment human interaction at the end of the day.
Yeah.
And it's got to start with that human interaction first.
Yeah. Brian, how do you see some of this playing out in the advocacy arena with advocacy organizations? My perception is that and this has always been, is that advocacy organizations, it's amazing the degree of innovation at play.
Given the resources.
I was wondering where you're going to go with that, because think they do push quicker than...
I agree.
...than their peers.
Given the resources.
Yeah.
We were talking about this the other day.
Yeah, but they don't have a lot of that legacy problem that an association has, you know, and they're often... much smaller, more nimble, and much more mission-driven, and therefore, you know, the sacred cows. Mm-hmm. There's less holding on to those things.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's usually very campaign-focused, which provides them to be nimble from campaign to campaign, because they actually can fail. If you are an association and you're trying something new, a strategy or a technology, and you have that once-annual event, you can't risk skipping a beat for a year. That could be extremely detrimental to the organization's efforts. But if you're running multiple concurrent campaigns or, you know, several across the course of a year, you know what? You can take a risk on one of them. Or this space is very collaborative, especially in the nonprofit world. Mm-hmm. It's also very young. Definitely a different mindset with that group. You know, they grew up with their hands on technology that changes every couple of years, and so they're not as afraid to take those risks or try new things. Mm-hmm. So it definitely, I would be interested to actually speak with more folks that do boots on the ground advocacy, because I'll admit my exposure has been mostly digital, which lends itself to quick change. But I just know, speaking from people that came off of like the Obama or Clinton campaigns, and talking about you know, local organizers and being able to communicate and actually do advocacy on the ground with volunteers, that has, you know, it has revolutionized over the last election cycle. So it's it's definitely a lot of fun working with advocacy folks, because I feel like you can, they're almost upset if you're a consultant and you're not suggesting at least one really cool cutting edge thing for them. Like they want, they know what works for their audience, but they also want to try something.
Right.
Or like A-B test it. That, you know, they're totally all about A-B testing. but they're definitely those folks on the digital side a little bit more willing to be experimental and also to hear critique. Mm-hmm. I think that is something that they don't necessarily shy away from. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. One of the outcomes coming from that March event with associations, the digital transformation, was the executive director that was on the panel, he said, Anne, what would be really helpful moving forward is having small meetings with consultant types and executive directors mixed in, where, you know, the, you know, current challenge of the day, what are we facing, and then how do we fix it? And he brought up millennials, and he said, here's my challenge, is that when I walk into the office, I have 6 videos. And he said, they just need some quick edits. And what I need is someone young and hungry who can learn editing, video editing in a day, edit the videos the next day, and post them the third day. And he said, do you know how long it will take with my current staff to make that happen? When I think of advocacy organizations, I think, I see plenty of examples of staff that could easily do that. I'm thinking of a colleague of ours who would just, you know, spend all of his waking hours doing something like that and eat that up. In an association, that would take 6 weeks.
Well, advocacy folks are used to wearing many hats.
Yeah.
If you're one of the, you know, the younger employees at one of those organizations, you probably have, you know, 5 or 6 jobs you're doing mm-hmm. during the average week. And if your boss comes to you and say, hey, you know, Susan or Jake, I know you went to school for photography, right? You can do video too, right? All right, you know, you're a video, you know, try it. You're a video guy for this week. Like that is not probably an uncommon conversation or scenario to be mm-hmm. had. Mm-hmm. At an association, I don't know. It's different
you
attitude.
Know, it seems like a related challenge is, you've got an organization which has saved the sea turtles, and someone coming out of college is like, I am going to go save the sea turtles. I'm going to work for a little money. I'm going to apply all my social media skills and edit your video and post it online really efficiently and do 1,000 different things. If you're the, you know, National Association of, you know, blah-de-blah, neuro-oncology, sociology, gynecology.
Nobody's young and hungry for that?
Well, it's, you know, the sex appeal is missing. So, and it's not that they don't
That's
do cool
a good
stuff.
Point.
You know,
yeah.
Like, I'll mention one of my clients by name, the American Society of Cell Biology, and they've got a coalition that they run called the Coalition for Life Sciences. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of big words and a lot of nerdy scientists, and they've been around for a while, and, you know, they're an association in many senses of the word. But, you know, they do, in the work that I do for them, they do these weekly briefings on the Hill, and they bring, like, the best scientists in the world to talk about some cutting-edge research, and it's really cool. Mm-hmm. But, you know, who goes to them? It's these old guys who, you know, show up to every single one of these things, and they're talking to each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there's a challenge to, like, how do you translate that into something that's, you know, mm-hmm. a little more broad appeal?
Mm-hmm. That's a really astute observation, I think. There is a certain sex appeal, if you will, to, you know, saving the environment when you're 19 and you're willing to roll up your sleeves and pretty much learn anything. Certainly. I know when I got out of college, that's what I was. I was working for a voter participation project. And it was pretty much you didn't know what you were going to do when you walked in the door every day. It was just like, okay, go copy these papers, or, oh, go do this.
Well, tell me, Anne, what is the risk of not doing anything? I mean, I think from your perspective, the world has changed, and there's an opportunity here to really transform the way that these services are delivered by leveraging some technology. But mm-hmm. what if you don't do it? Who cares?
I think I read this somewhere. I don't remember who the quote is by, but he said either you change, you proactively change, go about change, embracing change, or change is forced upon you and you need to react to it. And I do think that you could run that at an individual level or as an organization, but that's at play. Like at some point, you're going to be forced to change. And nobody, when that happens, that's never fun. So if you can proactively change and initiate that now, it's going to hurt, I think, a lot less. But, I mean, if you think about the way individuals change, they change also when they're forced, when your backup is against the wall. And that's when you make significant changes in your life. And usually it's not until that point that that happens. I think that's true with organizations, too. So this organization's as bleeding members for 3 decades. Like, it wasn't until it was like, okay, we do something now, or we might as well just close up shop.
Well, I think this actually rolls really well into, I think, an observation that got brought up on one of our previous podcasts. But that's the inherent makeup of the people that work at these organizations. And I think one of the things that you see with nonprofits is that somebody is going to go there for a year, 2, 3 years, 5 years. Very few people I know have worked at the same nonprofit more than 5 years. And it's all about making your name. You want to say, you know, when I was there, we did this. We launched this campaign. We had, you know, successful migration to this new CRM. We did something. And, you know, you're building your professional resume, but you are essentially in your head trying to make some change of note happen during your tenure. But if you're in an association, I imagine tenure there is much longer. And if you know you're going to be there for 20 years, there's no rush. There is no urgency. And actually maintaining the status quo is probably good for your job. So I think there is a propensity to risk-taking that people at nonprofits have simply because they're not going to be there in 3 to 5 years, and they want to say they did something good while they were.
I think that's very well said. Yeah, I think that's true. Yeah, I think that's that. I mean, you really hit it on the nail, Brian. I think that's absolutely true. I think you have a lot of people who have a vested interest in the way things are because for whatever reason it's working for them. And so change is not something that they're going to initiate because they don't have a vested interest in that.
And you brought up earlier, you know, that's where it might, you might hit a point where you need to bring in that new executive director that's going to make the hard choices to change the makeup of the organization.
Yeah. Recently with a client, I walked in, they were approaching a rebranding effort. And I said, I'd really love to come in and do a presentation around this because I like the idea of showing, because they're at a pivotal place as an organization in terms of where they're headed strategically. And I thought a rebrand is going to be really important in terms of positioning yourself for the future or kind of staying where you're at. So I thought that was a great opportunity to explore the much larger theme. And I said, I want to come in and I want to give you 5 examples of rebrands, not just nonprofit sector, but private sector as well. And then also 5 that went well and then 5 that didn't. And then run out examples and have a discussion around it. Just to, again, open up the doors, not necessarily go for a project, but I just wanted to kind of blow open the doors and get them thinking about how important this is in terms of their organization. But also what's possible if they do it right. And I walked in, and there was a group of, there was like 14 people in the room, their marketing department, IT department, their executive leadership. And at the end, I concluded the presentation, and I said, here's why I think this is so important. And I said, and at that time, the marketing department was saying, you know, we're reading a book on rebranding and we're going to do it in-house. And I came across very forcefully to them and I said, you won't get where you need to get by reading a book. And I was the most unpopular. I'm out. And with the marketing team, I was very, very unpopular, but it needed to be said because what they were embarking on was did not have to do with a new logo. It was something much bigger than that. Anytime you go about a rebranding, it has significant culture change, organizational change ramifications to it.
Yeah. And so what happened?
They're reading a book.
You know,
and I'm still unpopular with the marketing department.
The scary thing, I mean, you said earlier, what happens if you don't change? For some organizations, and I can think of several I've worked with in the past, they're dead and they just don't know it yet.
Yeah.
They are on that path where, short of a miracle, they are not going to recover. And they're fading into irrelevance. Mm-hmm. And so the cost of not changing is your organization usually will not just evaporate overnight, but it will fade into irrelevance through an irreversible course. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of organizations that are going down that trajectory. And you look at if you buy into global warming, and I am somebody who does, I think there is a threshold that you can pass, and it may be an irreversible course. And I think the same holds true for organizations. It may be too little, too late. Mm-hmm. And it's better to be ahead of that, making decisions on your own mm-hmm. terms and trying something. It's okay if, every course correction you make doesn't work. But mm-hmm. the point is that it's an iterative process, not something you do every 20 mm-hmm. to 30 years. It's something that's ongoing and continuous. Mm-hmm. And it's really sad to see these organizations that, back in the 60s or 70s may have been the pinnacle or lighthouse for their prospective movements. And now, they're run by unpaid interns and their finances are a disaster. Mm-hmm. And they just, barely can put out a newsletter. Mm-hmm. And they're still unwilling to change, though.
Right.
Even with all of that, and you look at the leadership and it's like, oh, leadership has not changed in 20 years. They've mm-hmm. just added on more VPs or more directors, mm-hmm. but they haven't actually changed anything. Mm-hmm. And clear that model's not working.
Right.
And it's a very difficult place to be as an organization, but if you can get buy-in to at least bring in an outside consultant before you get to that point, at least you're going to have some options to look at.
Mm-hmm. And I think one last comment touches on persuasion, right? How do you persuade someone to change, an organization to change? And it's all about the sort of where you stand is where you sit, like where you're at in the organization, how invested you're in the way things are being done now. But how do you, a team of consultants and I with associations are kind of working on this, how do you persuade someone to change who isn't naturally thinking that way, who for whatever reason is invested in the current situation? And it getting to the advocacy arena, I mean, I think I told you this story where I read this article a couple years ago. It was in the New York Times. It was about the environmental movement. And it was the leaders of all the environmental advocacy organizations, Sierra Club, the Nature's Conservancy, et cetera, and then some political consultants and communications type all in a room. And the conversation was around, the topic of the meeting was, we had incredible momentum and we lost it and we don't have a vision moving forward. So we've got a problem. How do we correct course? And a political consultant, I forget his name, but he said something I thought that was very astute. He said, the problem with the environmental movement, and he brought up specifically climate change, he said, you talk to your audience by showing them the back of the brownie box. Meaning you're saying, like, rationally,
here's the evidence, here are the statistics.
Yeah. Here's why brownies are bad for you. Nobody wants to see the back of the brownie box, right? No, that's not going to convince anybody. People always want to see the front of the brownie box. They want to see, okay, nice gooey brownie. I don't want the details. And he said, you need to flip that. You need to think about your approach in terms of what you're trying to sell, and you're trying to sell, supporting the environment, changing the environment, whatnot, saving the environment. And it needs to be aspirational. It needs to have an emotional hook. you're not going to convince people by showing them a research paper and showing the top 10 statistics. Even though rationally it's accurate, you're more likely to change people through an emotional. And I think sometimes that's where we trip up, is like, all right, here are the five reasons you need to change. And it's like, right, I know. And then you just keep doing what you're doing.
But it's also a problem of pandering to your most loyal advocates.
Yeah.
Rather than going after the people that are in the movable middle, the folks that, you know, you can shift the needle in your direction. Mm-hmm. And it's much easier to go after things that you and your network love and are going to give you positive feedback rather than the folks that are on the fence.
Mm-hmm.
But that's honestly, that's where ground is made. That's where you know, you have to go after them as much as you have to keep folks that have already convinced of your issue happy and engaged and communicating through their networks your organizational mission. You have to go after those people that haven't made up their mind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Agreed. Are we in an era of just ongoing transformation? I mean, is technology then moving so fast that it's not about adopting the new technology and making the change? It's about constant reinvention?
That's a great question.
If it is, that's a whole lot of running and running and running around in circles trying to catch your tail.
Yeah. It's sort of like this incremental improvements, like, you know, you could say that organizations are adapting to change as they go. And while it's not like there's no flipping of the lid, that there's small changes here and here and here. And digital transformation is not occurring in this kind of revolution way. It's more an evolution. And is there such an urgency that there needs to be, you know, more change faster, or is it something that you can evolve and grow at your own pace, at your own need? I don't know the answer to that. I would say there's more of an urgency, and I think this is what this report gets at. Like, you know, you're not adapting fast enough, and you're about to hit the iceberg. Would you say, Brian?
Yes and no. I think technology is a byproduct of organizational mission and needs.
Mm-hmm.
So the answer is yes, but technology doesn't steer. Technology isn't in and of itself the reason you use it. Nobody bought a computer because they wanted to find a reason to use that computer. They got rid of it because it allowed them to be more effective than a typewriter.
Mm-hmm.
Or that, if anyone remembers, hardware-based word processors that were around for a hot minute in the 80s. But yeah, technology is an enabler. It's a multiplier. If you're a one-person nonprofit, all the technology in the world isn't going to help you grow. You got to get out there and pound the pavement and do the hard work. And so it's an enabler and a multiplier. But you talk about culture and buy-in, and you have to have all of those things first. And the technology you choose will reflect it. So if you are a rapidly changing, innovating, and growing organization, your technology will probably... and adoption will probably mirror that.
Mm-hmm.
So you think about, you know, Silicon Valley, the folks that are launching you know, software startups out of there are going to be very quick to adopt new technology because they are quick to change. And if your organization is quick to change, you'll be quick to adopt new technology because it will be a reflection of the work you're doing. So you can't put technology first, but you can't also think of it as not you know, one side of the same coin when you talk about making organizational shifts. But I think it has to start with your team, and then you'll find the right technology to help them doing what they're trying to do.
Yeah.
So, Anne, how are you changing and evolving these days? That's an open-ended question.
It's actually,
you can take that any way you want.
One of the interesting things that happened to me recently was my approach to digital strategy is that the very first meeting that I have with a client is I don't even get into an actual website discussion. I talk about organizational strategy. And then as that conversation evolves, I take the organizational strategy, and then I tether it down to online. So what are the online goals? And make sure those connect. Make sure the online goals track back to what the organization is trying to achieve strategically. And then I caught myself, and this is something that I was so proud of, you know, I talk that talk all the time, and I'm like, here's how I'm going to show you how what I'm about to do with your website is actually going to help make you money to support this strategic goal in your plan. And then I was like, I'm actually doing the opposite of what I talk about in terms of digital transformation. Meaning, I'm still, the way I was doing the presentation, I was still presenting the website as this thing over here that's connected to this much bigger piece of the picture over here, and that it was being tethered down, where you're seeing more and more examples of what you do online actually should eventually become the center of what you're doing as an organization. It's no longer this thing that you build and redesign every 3 or 4 years. And so it completely shifted my thinking as a consultant. And I was saying digital transformation, how exciting over here, but in my actual day-to-day work with clients, I was actually doing what I said, you know, is part of the problem.
Mm-hmm. That seems to be really radical, though. I mean, if you think about the one-person nonprofit, there's an example of the website is the organization.
Mm-hmm.
If you're thinking about a large, established nonprofit organization, the website is a cost center in a line item on a budget.
Mm-hmm.
But, and maybe I'm just misunderstanding what you're saying, mm-hmm. but it really, I mean, what you're saying is that more and more that website is becoming the identity of the organization. And it should be an organizing principle for, I mean, like a top-down organizing principle.
My thinking hasn't evolved, but I think the line is not as... I think the line has blurred, meaning what is happening online, it begins to change
and
what
and
is happening.
By website, I think we're talking about social media
sure.
and all the other digital communication tools that you have for your organization.
Yeah. Because I'm trying to think of a program that would exist without an online presence.
Anybody?
Crickets. Can we put in crickets?
And what I'm really intrigued with is this conversation with in the UX field and then in the design field about how their roles are no longer like part of the web team or part of the marketing team or whatever. What they do is actually becoming at an executive level, like how they design an experience, how they do design an online experience has significant, because a lot of times the first touch a potential member or a potential advocate has with the organization is online.
Mm-hmm. I think this is part two. Of
podcast.
I mean that to me is really fascinating. It's you know, because, and this is the business that Brian was in, which is like, you know, how is your CRM and CMS, how is it serving the organization? How is it integrated into the organization?
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, I can't think of a whole lot of tools that an organization could adopt and fulfill that vision.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the technology is just not there. I mean, you still need an expert outside person to build it. It's still built very strictly and inflexibly. And there's almost always dramatic pain points involved in that.
Online software is going through a renaissance, but it is very much a growth and trial phase right now,
mm-hmm.
Which is why you shouldn't be afraid to try new things.
Mm-hmm.
You might be pleasantly surprised at, you know, these services and offerings out there.
Mm-hmm.
But what you are finding is consistently, though, a trend towards interchangeability. So mm-hmm. being able to easily move between systems. It's still not as painless as probably anyone would like it to be, but we're getting there. Even websites are starting to get to a point. You know, the new Drupal 8, their big thing is Drupal is going to be the database, and your website is just a expression of the data that's been collected
mm-hmm.
through their database. So mm-hmm. there is this disambiguation of data and human interaction
mm-hmm.
that is happening.
What was that word?
Human interaction?
No, the other one. Disambiguation.
Disambiguation.
I was impressed, too. I like that.
A separation. A distinct separation.
I want something to check
it out. Lucky can be our...
It's mid-afternoon on a Friday, too.
Yeah, Lucky That's can be our fact checker.
And we're not drinking.
Oh,
okay. Sorry, Charity Engine.
But there's this separation that's happening for everyday users between their data and how that interaction with the data happens. Because mm-hmm. at the end of the day, the internet is really one big series of forms. Whether you're entering information into Excel that then gets imported into some website or service, or you're typing in your information to write a blog, it's all forms. The internet is forms and it's a collection of data. But what makes it so appealing is how you interact with that. And that human interaction piece is really the renaissance, the revolution that's happening right now. You look at Apple, you look at Google, they're investing in design. You can't be a competitive firm that does not have a good UX, mm-hmm. which is completely different from good UI. You know, user experience is completely different from the user interface. It could look beautiful, but you can't use it. Mm-hmm. There's horrible user experience. checks in and of themselves, I don't think they're very pretty, but they get the job done.
Yeah.
There's not many mistakes that happen on checks. So really good, really good usability, but they're not that pretty.
So Anne, Dr. Yoder's final thoughts.
Final thoughts. I think
if you could leave, if you were talking to the annual ASAE meeting in Florida, where all the association executives are gathered, and you're giving the keynote address, what would your concluding slide say?
Just come up with that on the spot. No pressure.
Yeah.
I think it would go back to what I said earlier: is you can either initiate change, or change can be forced upon you, and you have that choice.
So, do you want to be the agent of change?
Do I want to be the agent?
Like, that's what the organization should be asking. Do they want to be?
Do they want to be the agent?
Or do they want change to be forced upon them?
Indeed, yeah, I think that's it.
So we this is our first set piece, which we did last night. We did, and it worked out pretty well. Question for you: mm-hmm. What is your favorite nonprofit
right now?
Favorite nonprofit?
Just off the top of your head.
We're giving out plugs.
Is that right? It's Red Wiggler Farm in Gaithersburg, Maryland, who employs disabled adults, and it's an organic farm.
Have you do volunteer work there? Or you get is that where you get
your, volunteer work?
Your food from? Uh-huh.
Yeah, I have
they called CSA.
A good friend.
And they're
who,
a CSA, right?
They're a CSA.
I've heard of them. Yes,
and it's an absolutely just ridiculously charming nonprofit, and they just incredible. Coming from Pittsburgh, steel mill town, mm-hmm. and my heritage, my father and my uncles and whatnot. There's a real work ethic, and mm-hmm. so there's like. Why I connect so emotionally to this nonprofit is that the role of meaningful work, it gives so much to people that you don't fully realize it. You think, oh, I got to go to my job. It's Monday. Oh, yay, it's Friday. I'm done with my job. But the impact that it has on your life is huge. So for the developmentally disabled, the fact that they can go and contribute and be a part of something is significant for them. And then it's a great organic farm with vegetables and...
That's great.
Mm-hmm. And they, I believe are they the ones that you can either pay an annual membership or some of that is waived if you go volunteer at the farm?
I think you can volunteer in a
like several hours a year
waived.
Or something?
Yeah, uh-huh. Yep.
So how can people get a hold of you? Is there anything going on? And I think this is probably going to air a week from Monday.
Okay.
So that may be after your big series of events. But
yeah.
Do a little self-promoting, Ian.
You can get a hold of me through my email address. It's ann.yoders@gmail.com.
A-N-N-E?
A-N-N.
A-N-N?
Yeah, no E on the A-N. My website is actually going through some revisions right now, but typically it's at annyoders.com. And doing work, some interesting work across the board, working with a couple clients on the West Coast and then a couple clients here on the East
Coast. Hollywood.
I guess.
Hollywood on this, yeah.
Doing a really, very interesting project with our friend Nathaniel. He'll be, I hope this, so he doesn't mind
Nathaniel
me.
Nathaniel Perlman, NGP band.
NGP Software, yeah. He has a company now, Graphicacy, and he'll be doing a contest. He's looking to hire some new developers and designers, and so we're doing a contest to get the word out about Graphicacy and also jobs.
Is this like as a recruiting tool he's doing this contest?
It's part recruiting tool, but also part brand awareness for Graphicacy.
We'll have to get him on here and ask him these questions.
Yeah, but he one of the things we're looking at is doing a... he does information design, so doing something on baseball, and I'm a huge baseball fan.
Pirates?
Pirates, yeah. They're doing pretty good this year.
Are they? I have no idea.
Are you guys a Washington fan?
In theory. Yeah. I have a hat.
They're the local team. You're a Washington fan, right?
I'm going to pass on this question.
Okay. No problem.
I have no loyalty to any any team.
Okay.
Great. Well, thanks for coming by, Anne. We'll have you back for part deux when we talk about how the website reflects the organization or the other way around. Mm-hmm. But thanks for coming.
My pleasure.
Do you want to say goodbye?
Goodbye.